also wants to educate and help people realize what's going on in the world today in terms of human rights violations and genocide. And so we're very proud to be working with you on this issue at one of the several events, 10 days of the series. There's some pamphlets in the back for those of you who would like to have more information on the series. You'll see the Formidable d'évaluation qu'on vous demande de remplir avant votre départ. Et on est vraiment honoré de travailler ce soir et de vous être ici pour écouter ce que je suis en train de faire. Alors, c'est une bonne soirée. Merci.
So, so that is, I think, something like the 8th or 9th consecutive lecture in this series, which we've been running for 8 or 9 years in collaboration with the Holocaust Memorial series. And tonight we have a guest that comes from afar, not just to talk to us, but he's come from afar recently to Quebec, Canada. Albert Petit, who was until very recently the international court prosecutor of the extraordinary changes of the courts of Cambodia, as he will explain, a hybrid tribunal created jointly by the UN and the Cambodian government to try authors of international crimes during the Khmer Rouge period. We discovered 2 months ago that Mr. Petit and I were actually in law school together, although we have no recollection of it, which is perhaps something about our law school experience.
Moving on.
He's actually older than I am, by 6 years. After graduating from U of M, went to work for the provincial attorney general, the Crown Prosecutor. Had a business, it's really quite a long list of what he did. Then worked for 3 years as a legal advisor with the prosecution of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Then 1 year as a legal advisor to the UN mission in Kosovo. Then back to Canada to work for the Federal Crown with the War Crimes Unit at the Justice Department in Ottawa. Then to East Timor to work with the hybrid tribunal created in East Timor to try international crimes in that area. Then 1 year with the Office of the Prosecutor at the Sierra Leone Special Court in Freetown, and then finally 3 years in Phnom Penh as the National Co-Prosecutor of the Extraordinary Chamber of the Courts of Cambodia. As I told him, the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia seems to be the only international tribunal that he has not yet worked with. But they haven't closed down yet, so who can tell? So he's going to share with us his thoughts on the ECCC, and that will be followed by a commentary by my colleague Payam Acharman, who himself was a prosecutor at the ICTY for a number of years before joining the faculty. And then we'll have an opportunity for you to ask questions if you have.
You might want to wait, you don't know that. Okay. Well, good evening, everybody. Je remercie le centre de l'invitation et j'espère que je vais être à la hauteur de mes prédécesseurs dans la série de conférences. Et avec votre permission, je vais m'adresser à vous en anglais for the simple reason that the slides that I mostly cut and pasted from another presentation are in English. As Professor Provost said, in a nice way, I have been around, and Cambodia was the fourth international tribunal or hybrid tribunal in which I worked. So, with your permission, I will talk to you a little bit, give you a bit of an overview of the ECCC, the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia, or the Khmer Rouge Tribunal, the KRT, whatever you want to call it. And I will also, acknowledging the theme of the lectures, talk to you a little bit about genocide, as you saw from the title of the presentation. It's something that we in the field, especially those who worked with the Rwanda Tribunal and the ECCC. I've had occasions a lot to think about and to see the practical realities behind the application of the law. So it's given rise to a lot of writing, a lot of talking, and hopefully what I'm about to tell you will contribute in a positive way to that. First, a bit of background on Cambodia, for those not old enough to remember. In 1975, in April 1975, after a protracted conflict, a group of people, a group of Cambodians that eventually came to be revealed as the Khmer Rouge, communist-inspired group, took power in Phnom Penh. For the next 3 years, 8 months, and 20 days, they proceeded to do something that few movements or individuals have ever tried to do, which was to fundamentally alter Cambodian society along ideological lines. So we alleged as the prosecution, chose to do so by any means necessary, including criminal means. The cost of that was about what most people agree, 1.7 million dead men, women, and children after those three years, 8 months, and 20 days. After being overthrown following an invasion by the Vietnamese armed forces, the Khmer Rouge remained a political and, to a certain extent, military force to be reckoned with, so much so that for years thereafter, even after their extent of their crimes became internationally known, they kept on being the official representative of Cambodia for some members of the international communities. You have to remember that this was the Cold War, and friends were more important than truth or justice. As I said, their experiment had an incredible impact on the country, and that is still being felt today. And I think a lot of the ills of the current ills of the country, and there are many, unfortunately, for the Cambodian people, can be traced directly back to the Khmer Rouge regime and its impact. As I said, the Khmer Rouge wanted to create a new Cambodia, Kampuchea, Democratic Kampuchea, and it could be said a new Khmer race to a certain extent. Every single right, every single individual right that anybody can think of were forbidden, eliminated, proscribed, and repressed. They eliminated banks, markets, right to speak, right to think, right to live. They also forced a mass evacuations of the cities, forcing people to live communally and enroll them, or forcefully enroll them, into a huge forced labor project. You remember the Great Leap Forwards that were the rage during a certain era? Well, they had their own version of it. And as I said, these forced projects, forced labor project, contributed great deal to the massive death toll. And I think it's fair to say that every single Cambodian today alive is either a survivor or certainly a victim of the Khmer Rouge up to today. When I went to Cambodia, the first outreach session that I attended, outreach where you go and speak directly to people, to generally the victims, I was surprised by some of the questions that had to do with the why. When I was in Rwanda, there was no why. Everybody knew why it happened, or at least the victims knew. If you were a Tutsi in Kigali in 1994, you knew why you were being hunted down. It was very clear. Even in Sierra Leone, with the apparent mindless violence of that conflict, the victim still knew what was behind it. But it wasn't clear at the time in Cambodia, and it's still not clear 30 years after partly as a, because then, when you were being victimized and killed, to understand it was very difficult, because it was done for, as I said, ideological reasons and somewhat obscured. And because of a lack of education since then, it's only this year, actually, that that period is going to be formally taught in high schools of the country. And the will of a certain class, a certain political class, to basically bury the past, to quote the Prime Minister. Well, there's a whole generation of Cambodians who've grown up not knowing what happened to their parents or grandparents. There's a whole section of victims who don't know why they were subject to what they were subjected to. And what was remarkable to me as well is that these, some of these young people don't believe their parents when their parents are willing to talk about what happened. They cannot believe that Khmer would kill Khmer for something called communism. And there's a documentary that was done by an NGO directed by a Canadian woman, actually, who documented this phenomenon. And I found that the most, one of the saddest, I guess, things that I experienced there. How you can't even believe your parents when they tell you what happened to them because it's so strange. Well, the court, you know, for better or for worse, has the potential to answer that why, fundamental why question, and is expected to do so by a good segment of the population. I say for better or for worse because I don't think criminal courts are the best to tell history. They're not made for that. The process is not geared toward the shades of gray of history, but rather a black and white finding of beyond a reasonable doubt. But you know, courts can do that, and hopefully this one will. A little bit of history, how this court came about. In 1997, the then co-prime ministers, there's a lot of co's in recent Cambodian history, the co-prime ministers requested the help of the UN in setting up a tribunal to judge the Khmer Rouge and their crimes. And right after the letter was posted, started backtracking on it. It took 7 long years of very acrimonious negotiations. At one point, the UN walking out for this tribunal to exist for an agreement to be ratified. The problem, I think, can come down to the Cambodian position of wanting a national solution, a Cambodian solution to a Cambodian problem, and to a large extent, a control over that process. Versus the UN's stand that this process had to be up to international standards and something that the UN could live up to. That, however, the drive was overwhelming to a certain extent, despite the hesitations of both parties, and eventually the agreement was signed. The agreement called for a hybrid court, as Sopovo said, which means that nationals and internationals work side by side, and national and international are applied. It is, I think, fair to say that the Extraordinary Chambers is probably the most hybrid of hybridized court. It is the first in which the national components, the national staff from administration to judicial, have the majority. And the internationals are the minority. And we can talk about one of the many original points of the court, which is the supramajority of the judges necessary to reach any positive decision, which was probably the final compromise that made this court happen. I'll be happy to talk about that if you want. But the court was created, and it gave jurisdiction over senior leaders and those most responsible. In Sierra Leone, we had those who bear the greatest responsibility. In the statute, in ICTR and ICTY, those prerequisites became clear after, not necessarily in the statutes. But the language of the court calls for what I think are, you know, two criteria, objective and subjective. Objective being senior leaders, being somebody in a hierarchy. Subjective meaning somebody who amongst killers and mass murderers stood out and had to be someone whose influence was necessary for the crimes to reach that sort of magnitude. The usual unfortunately by now usual crimes, genocide crimes against humanity, war crimes. A few interesting ones that I'm not sure are crimes, but were put in there anyways. Offenses against protected persons and religious symbols. And national crimes. And national crimes being murder, torture, religious persecution. Our temporal jurisdiction is April 75 to January 79. The ECCC's temporal jurisdiction. And again, all these, from the personal jurisdiction of senior leaders, those most responsible to the time frame, are obviously political considerations or have been inspired by political considerations. The court, as I said, is a hybrid court, and it is based on a civil law system, a continental French-inspired system, because that's the law of Cambodia. It's been since during and since colonial times. So we have an office of the co-prosecutors, who are one national and one international, who are tasked with conducting preliminary investigations, requesting the formal investigations of suspects, and who are then have the burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the guilt of any of the accused, and that up to, of course, the final decision and appeal. You have an office of the co-investigative judges, two of them, a national and an international, a French judge, who, according to this system, have the mandate to gather all the relevant evidence, both inculpatory and exculpatory. That is their duty. And at the end, they must make the decision to send to trial after having referred to the co-prosecutors and asking their opinion for charges which, according to them, the accused can stand trial on. There is a trial chamber, of course, who has to decide on the first leg, and a Supreme Court chamber. Between, or in the interim, there is a pre-trial chamber who was originally tasked with, originally, according to the statutes and the agreement, originally tasked to basically resolve conflicts between the co-prosecutors or between the co-investigative judges. That was their sole jurisdiction, because everybody expected that there would be conflicts, and they were right. But that jurisdiction was much expanded because from the get-go, we realized that, for example, not having somebody who could rule on bail could be a problem. So the jurisdiction of the pretrial chamber was much expanded and has actually generated a lot of preliminary decisions which are of some interest. The administration, reflects, again, the dual nature. Every head of section is a national, a Cambodian, and the deputies are internationals and the staff intermingled. Different stage, as I said, preliminary investigation, followed by a judicial investigation, a trial, and an appeal. Those estimates, which were done a while ago, actually proved quite remarkably accurate. The first trial, which is DOIC, which I'll speak in a minute, will last, if the judgment is rendered on time, around 9 months. Now, one of the things that you always face when you're involved in this process is the victims asking you, why is it taking so long? Why do you need so much money? We all know what happened. Why can't you just get on with it? And you try to explain, and if you're not, hopefully you're not foolish enough to try and satisfy people, but hope to make somewhat a reasonable explanation of why these cases take so long. Because they involve the most complex factual and legal situations known to courts anywhere. It's mind-boggling the amount of information that you have to put, that you have to sift through, the conditions in which you have to do it in. Remember, you're creating a court. You're importing people from different backgrounds, different language, different professional experience. You're asking them to look at events that happen on a massive scale and make legal decisions, very complex legal decisions, based on what is what now, maybe 15 years of jurisprudence, just about. And you're asking them to do that, of course, on the cheapest budget possible and the shortest time possible and under the glare of survivors, witnesses, civil society, the media, and everybody else. The first introductory submission, the first case, if you want, had five suspects, and involved, as I illustrate here, a massive amount of documentation and information. And that's one of the things you find as well, is that you have to explain to people the difference between information and evidence. You have to explain to people, you have to hopefully convince victims that they may know what happened to them, of course. They may believe that they know what happened to their neighbor, and they may have heard what happened to the other guys somewhere else, but our task is not to establish what probably happened. The task of any court is to establish beyond a reasonable doubt what happened. And that takes evidence. That takes evidence that is tested up to the point that it is beyond any doubt what happened. And that's a huge difference. And that was a particular conundrum with Cambodia, because you had 30 years that passed between the crimes and the accounting. And in those 30 years, people have made careers out of documenting what happened. NGOs have survived years and years on funding, gathering what they believe are evidence of what happened. And therefore, as I said, everybody knows what happened. Well, one of the first things we had to explain, as I said, is the difference between that, between knowing something and proving it beyond a reasonable doubt, which is why you need a massive amount of evidence. As I said, the first case had five individuals. Eventually, that first case was separated by the co-investigative judges, with one case going forward, that of Doik, who was the head of a detention center called S21, or 12 Slang, who has now stood trial, or is standing trial, rather, because the final arguments are scheduled for, I believe, in 2 weeks from now. And then there will be probably about 2 or 3 months for the judgment and sentencing. Notice I say sentence, because the individual is essentially pleading guilty. But unfortunately, in the continental system, in a civil system, you can't plead guilty. You can say until you're blue in the face that you did it and you want to be sentenced, but the judge still has to do a trial. If this case had been done in any other hybrid tribunal or international tribunal that I worked in, it would have been over in 2006. There's plus and minuses to the two systems, and I'd be glad to address them on another day. But he will eventually, as I said, be sentenced, and it'll be very interesting, not only for the factual basis of that judgment, but because there are some interesting legal issues that will be hopefully determined by the trial chamber in that judgment. The other case, as you said, was the initial one was split in two. The other case involves the four, well, technically still Doik, but basically the four main defendant or surviving architects of the Khmer Rouge era. The former number two of the regime, Nguyen Chea, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs, Yang Sari, his wife, the former Minister of Social Affairs, and the former head of state, Khieu Samphan. Obviously, there's a lot of issues with trying these crimes 30 years after, one of which, a very important one, is the lack of suspects, the lack of perpetrators. A lot of them, those senior leaders, the most responsible, have gone to their graves without any accounting for their actions, unfortunately. There is obviously, as well, the difficulty of finding surviving witnesses who can remember, who are willing to testify, and whose testimony can be believed. It's one of the issues that is, of course, the most, one of the things that keeps you up at night as a prosecutor is being able to put the best evidence forward. But to have that evidence, you have to have people, you have to have documents, you have to have forensic, you have to have it. And in Cambodia, it was particularly difficult thinking that every single day, basically, some piece of evidence was literally dying. But we did, the co-prosecutors, we did manage, as I illustrated earlier, to put together what I thought was substantive evidence, and that's been now bettered, let's say, by the judicial investigation. One of the other issues, which is also always an issue in tribunals of these natures, hybrid tribunals, is a translation issue. This was, however, a more acute issue with the Cambodian tribunal because it's the first trilingual tribunal. as I said, Cambodia, being quite insistent on its national priorities, insisted that Khmer, of course, and legitimately still, of course, be an official language. English was one because it's the international language of political negotiations and international criminal law. And French, because, as I said, the system, the national system, is French-inspired, and the French are the second biggest donor of the court. So we have a trilingual court. However, I would assume, hopefully, the best-case scenario is that nobody gave any thought to how much money this would involve, translating every single thing in three languages, or the potential of having to do so. For those of you who knew the Tadic decision from the ICTY, a seminal decision, you're talking about hundreds of pages of sometimes quite arcane, with all due respect, language, translated into Khmer, which doesn't have the same concepts as English. So it was, and it remains, a big issue with the court, and necessitated a lot of advocacy for additional funding, and it's still, unfortunately, a major issue. And you have, of course, we now have, 15 years of this type of prosecution. So we have, and we were discussing that a little bit earlier, there's a cadre, I apologize for the use of the term, but there is a cadre of lawyers all across the world who have either practiced in prosecution or in defense or both. And you now have some very gifted defense attorneys who are necessary and fundamentally so to the process in testing it. And so that gave rise and is still giving rise to a lot of challenges that need to be addressed. But as I've said previously, one of my most difficult professional experiences has been in East Timor, where in 2002 there was literally no defense. What we had there were lawyers right out of formal training with absolutely no experience, and some internationals who were there to help them, and they were defending people literally for their lives. And as a prosecutor, if you want this to matter, if you want to be able to live with yourself, but if you want the process to be worth something, you then are in a position of having to do both jobs. You have to literally make sure that every argument that should be raised is raised. You have to make sure that the judges also do their job and toe the line and help the defense in doing what its job. So a strong, well-funded and qualified defense teams is fundamental to the process. Otherwise, what you're doing won't amount to much. I will not, however, speak about judges. Now, as I said, factually, there is a lot of legal issues with the Cambodia Tribunal. And a lot of it will get hashed out in this first judgment. Not a lot of it. Some of them will get settled in the first judgment. And if the sentence is not what Mr. Doik or his lawyer expect in the appeal. And hopefully some of the more fundamental issues will also be decided during the course of the second case. Because the second case, as I said, really concentrates on the architects of the Khmer Rouge period. And the crucial issues there will be decided, including probably GCE, which is a very important part of this sort of prosecution. The issues that we did indeed had to face right from the beginning were interesting, and some of them were quite novel for me. The court is, by statute, must apply Cambodian law. And when there is something that is not clear, or a lacuna, or a contradiction, it must look toward international law. And according to the agreement and the statute, which didn't make any sense, every intervener, from the co-prosecutors to the investigative judges to the trial chambers, had the opportunity to interpret the law at each of their respective jurisdiction or tasks. Well, that didn't make sense, as I said. So the first year, the judges spent basically drafting internal rules, the guidebook, the playbook by which everybody was supposed to play by. And they did. And they tried to incorporate these these two concepts. National law is very difficult in Cambodia. Because of the recent history, it's a bit of a mess. Different governments have passed different legislation. The UN has passed also its own legislation when it was in charge, some of it quite contradictory, interestingly enough. And it is very unclear what is Cambodian law or national criminal law, although it was very unclear then. And there is also a big confusion that has happened sometimes when there is this lack of formal encadrement, is that practice becomes law or becomes thought of as law. There is, as of last month, finally a criminal code that's been adopted by the National Assembly in Cambodia. But up until then, we didn't. So what the judges did, as I said, is to try and mold together common law-inspired international criminal law and the national law or civil French system and practice. Now, there's some very interesting peculiar issues with Cambodia. There's in 1979, there was a trial in absentia held by the Vietnamese. Of two individuals, Pol Pot and Yang Sari. I say in absentia because those two, of course, were in the bush and had no intention of coming out. It was a very interesting process, actually. The evidence that was gathered, as is sometimes the case, you can look to the Iraq tribunal for another example. The evidence was quite compelling and quite interesting. The process, however, wasn't that great. The first address by the defense lawyer for Yang Sari and Pol Pot was that my clients, those genocidal monsters, are of course guilty or something to that effect. So the process was not really up to snuff. But they were tried, and they were found guilty, and sentenced. They were basically charged with what was called genocide, but what looked a lot like crime against humanity if you read the indictment. So one of the first issues that had to be dealt with that came up quite fast, actually, in the bail hearing and then in an appeal to the pretrial chamber was res judicata for Yang Sari, having been tried in absentia. The pretrial chamber, as it is sometimes want to do, basically kick the ball to the trial chamber, and we'll see what if we have a final decision on that. But they did reflect on it, and it's an interesting issue. There's also some pardon and an amnesty given following the defection of the majority of the Khmer, which led by Yang Sari, to the government fold. So that issue also came up. The national crimes were the object of a statute of limitation that was retroactively extended to allow the ECCC to have jurisdiction. There was the detention of Mr. Doik, who, along with another individual who died basically the week I showed up in Phnom Penh, who was detained basically 7 years illegally detained, basically. What do you do about that? Well, the trial chamber decided that they were going to give him credit, of course, when he is found guilty for those years that he spent illegally detained. And there is, and there probably will always be, a question, external questions with the court that should not be there, that should not be attracted by any court, but there is a question of political influence. A possible political influence on the judges or on the process by the present government. There is the question of corruption, administrative or perhaps judicial, of victims, basically, sitting as judges of perpetrators. Various questions. There's also substantive legal issues, some of which the Professor Provost Center contributed to, and a very important contribution it was. Some of which are, basically, how do you determine what was the law then? As some of you know, you can't be prosecuted for a crime if it wasn't a crime when you committed it, of course. So we have to figure out what in 1975 to 79, what were the elements of crimes against humanity, genocide, war crimes, et cetera, et cetera. One of the possible issue was during that period, 1975 to 79, were crimes against humanity needed to have a nexus with an armed conflict to constitute crimes against humanity? It's an issue sometimes that does come up. In Freetown, we had, I'm going to say the privilege, I guess. Yeah, we had the privilege of determining that the use of child soldier was a crime in international law. And that has withstood appeal, and I'm very proud of that. So there's different issues. One of the probably most difficult issues that the court will face and is facing is that of genocide. And that's why, if you'll allow me, I'd like to reflect a little bit on with you. Allegedly, Churchill once said that genocide was a crime without a name. So flabbergasted was he with the extent of the Holocaust. Well, true or not, it is indeed a type of crime that, as Anna Arendt said, sort of defies definition and defies even imagination. It is, however, and that's my premise, a very specific concept with a very specific purpose and deserving of respect. Now, as some of you know, probably most of you if you're here, genocide did not exist or would not have existed without the tireless advocacy and brilliance of a man called Raphael Lemkin, who through his years as an advocate for the recognition of the specificity of the crimes of the Nazis managed to be the driving force behind the recognition of the term that he coined, genocide, and the convention that sought or is seeking to prevent and punish the crime. And for him, genocide was a coordinated plan of different actions aiming at the destruction of essential foundations of the life of national groups with the aim of annihilating the group themselves. And I think it's very important to reflect on that definition, and to think of the context. We're talking basically 1946 to 1948, if I'm not mistaken, and scholars will correct me. Those 2 years during which the parties negotiated and hammered out the convention. And Raphael Lemkin, going from office to office, from individual to individual, and trying to get them to recognize and to sign. And of course, different state parties had different agendas, but eventually in 48, the convention was signed. And as you know, it recognizes that genocide is a crime considered a crime amongst the community of nations. And it consists of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. And, of course, defines various measures and ways of committing it. Obviously, I think we can all think of the convention as a very important step in, humanity trying to define what it stands for, nations trying to enunciate clearly principles which must govern all of them. But obviously, I think 60 years in the history of humanity is probably, not probably, it is not enough to judge the progress, but hopefully we'll get there. Because there's still a need for the convention and probably will be for the next foreseeable future. As with other tribunals, the ECCC adopted essentially the terms of the convention in its statute, except for one typo. Free coffee for somebody who notices it first. Good, I don't have any change. It's in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group such as, instead of as such. But anyways. So adopted basically the convention. Now, as I said, the lucky four. It's not from cynicism, trust me. I've been doing this long enough to respect the events. But we have to be mindful of what the text says. What the parties agreed to was clearly to protect four groups. national, ethnical, racial, or religious. There's glaring omissions that all of us can see, I'm sure. And quite clearly, it would have been fascinating to be a fly on the wall during those negotiations. But there were a lot of interests conflicting during the negotiations. And if you remember 46, 48, 50s, there's a lot of nations that were doing a whole sorts of things to people under their care that had interests in certainly limiting the ambit of the convention. So what the Genocide Convention does, it forces parties to prevent and prosecute acts of genocide committed against a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. Now, as probably all of you know, nobody talked about genocide in Nuremberg because it didn't exist in law. What Nuremberg talked about was the extermination of the Jews. So the first first judgment of genocide following Nuremberg was the Akhenaten judgment from the International Criminal Tribunals for Rwanda. Now, I won't go into a lot of... it's quite interesting, actually, how a lot of times law comes down to the individuals and how, depending on who's there at the right time or the wrong time, a concept or an issue becomes takes a life of its own. Well, Akayesu had to struggle with applying the convention. And one of the issues, one of the struggles was, which are the groups? How do you define those groups? Because I'm sure if every one of you would probably with a different definition of what is, for example, a religious group or a national group, okay? At least certainly for the purpose of extending to it protection of a treaty. So Akayesu did come up with a way of determining what constituted the concept of a group, and came up among its findings with the notion of stable by birth or stable group. Right. Well, as some have observed from the decision, Bill Chavez being one of them, that had the effect of really broadening the protection of the convention. In a way that was clearly not what the framers of the treaty sought, even though Akayesu did go back to the founding documents or the negotiations to try and interpret the concept. Well, Kayashima, from ICTR, the second decision itself, sort of like righted the court, and basically came up with its own definition of what constitute these four groups, quite in a almost offhand way, basically sending the message that that's not an issue. And it is very difficult. It is a very difficult process to try and determine who should be protected from this, who should have the benefit of the convention. And the decision in Jelcic says, it's a very dangerous process, because by defining the group, you necessarily have to exclude some people, and you have to use means that are not necessarily probably be unanimously approved, and you have to resort to a lot of acrobatics, let's say, sometimes. I think now that ICTY as well has got to look into this and apply its mind to it, I think there's a consensus now that I think will hopefully will be used by or will follow through with the ECCC, which is to basically see the four criteria as elements to be used together. In assessing, sort of like a basket, okay? And if you fall within that basket, one way or the other, then you should be protected. And I think that really goes to what the essence of what Lemkin and the convention, I think, tried to do, which is to protect what was then which was thought of as a national group. Basically, the image of, you know, the state or a huge organ of the state going after a minority of people for their perceived belonging to a certain group. Which brings us to the question of the Cambodian problem. The Cambodian problem, as I said, is one of definition or the application of those definitions. Doik, who is now on trial, was, as I said, the head of S21, Tuol Sleng, a detention center in the heart of Phnom Penh, which for about almost 3 years, basically. Arrested, detained, tortured, held in inhumane conditions, and eventually executed, probably between 12,000 and 17,000 men, women, and children. When the Vietnamese came, when they walked in that that place, Doik and the remaining guards and a few of the remaining victims, some of whom are still alive today, had long fled. But when they walked in, they discovered this former school. It's a former lycée, ironically enough. And they discovered this location. They discovered, among other things, thousands of pages of documents, because one of the things that Doik did was to document the forced confessions of the detainees and left them behind, a fact of which that Munchea, you know, reproached him after his fleeing the scene. They found instruments of tortures. They found bodies. They found a nightmarish location that they sought to preserve for their own political, you know, purpose, no doubt about it. But they did create what they decided to call the S21 Genocidal Museum. And to this day, the plaque, when you turn in the street to go there, it's called the Genocidal Museum. And you go in there, and it's quite an evocative location. The cells are still there. There's been a lot of changes, obviously, but the cells are still there. There's photographs. Certainly one of the most difficult part of the exhibit is the photographs of the children, some of which with little numbers, little kids, 5, 6 babies, whose photographs were taken before they were executed. So you look at these kids, and you know that a few hours or a few days after, their heads were smashed against a tree, or they were their throats were cut, and they were buried along with their parents. But it is called the Genocidal Museum. And the people who ended up there, they ended up there because the Khmer Rouge thought that they were the enemy. They were the enemy of the revolution. They were standing in the way of that society that they were seeking to create. They were either CIA, KGB, Vietnamese, Khmer bodies with Vietnamese heads. Because you see, the system could not in itself fail. It was failing badly. People were starving. Those huge works weren't working. It wasn't going anywhere. But it couldn't be the system itself, of course. So it had to be something else. So it had to be enemies. It had to be enemies borrowing from within. It had to be people who were sabotaging. So they sought to eliminate all these perceived enemies. And they brought them to S21, to other detention centers, to the killing fields, or they killed them where they stood. One of my friends in Cambodia was now an airline pilot. And he was a kid when in 1975, 79. And he got forcibly evacuated from Phnom Penh, got separated from his parents, ended up in a cooperative. And one day, the Khmer Rouge leader called all the kids to the central place. And he brought a bike. And he asked each of the kids if they could ride the bike. Now, my friend had grown up in Phnom Penh, 5, 6, 7 years old at the time, I think. So he knew how to ride a bike. So he said, yeah, I know how to ride a bike. And he took the bike. But as soon as he started on the bike, he hit a root, and he fell off. So the Khmer Rouge leader thought that he could not ride a bike, that he didn't know how to ride a bike, that he had grown up without a bike. So he had been poor. So he was okay. It was okay because all the kids who managed to ride the bikes, well, the day after, they disappeared and they were never seen again. So they were killed because they were the enemy, because they came from an enemy class of people, or were thought to be, or could have been. At, you know, eventually, the madness was such that whole families were wiped out because they could have been enemies, or they were associated with enemies, or they had been named in a forced confession because the guy was talking and talking and talking because that's the only way he could survive, so he couldn't then, so he would name names. So all these people were eliminated eventually. But they were killed by Khmers, by people who, by all accounts, are the same ethnic, religious, national group. And that's why the term autogenocide started. Somebody came up with the idea that people killing themselves, basically, well, that was an autogenocide. You had to find a name for it, right? It boggles the mind, so you have to be able to call it something. Well, they called it autogenocide. There's a problem with that. First of all, autogenocide doesn't mean anything. And genocide itself means a very specific thing. It means the protection extended to four groups. And one of those groups is not a political group. Now, try and imagine Russia in 1948 agreeing to protect members of a political group. Didn't happen, did it? There's a reason for that. Well, whatever the reason is, though, that's the convention, that's the statute, that's the law. So political groups are not protected, but the majority of the victims of the Khmer Rouge were killed because they were thought to be politically incorrect, to be enemies of the regime. There were, and I think there is a case to be answered, for massive killings of specific groups, Vietnamese, Chams, Muslims, minority in Cambodia, perhaps even maybe Chinese minority. And those would fit within one of the four groups. But the vast majority of victims of the Khmer Rouge and the survivors today were not victimized because they were a member of one of the four four protected groups. But try and explain that to them. Try and convince people that what they went through is not genocide. Because we have come to equate genocide with the moral outrage that this sort of crimes calls for. And one of the toughest jobs you have as a prosecutor or as somebody involved in this sort of thing is to explain to people that their expectation might not be validated by the legal process. But it does not mean that it did not happen today. It does not mean that what they went through wasn't horrific. It just means that it doesn't fit within one particular legal concept that is very precise, and that needs to be so. But as I said, if you get into this business and stay in this business by believing that you can make people happy about what you have to tell them, you're in the wrong one. And you should look at something else. But it is obviously one of the major issues that we faced in Cambodia, that the court will continue to face. But I think, again, to quote somebody else, that the crime of crimes does need to exist. And earlier, well, at the beginning I asked, does genocide matter? I think it does matter. It came into existence for a particular reason. For the first time, the community of nations decided to confront something so horrific that it gave it a name and it signed an agreement to prevent it and punish it. Because of its specificity, right? That's what it wanted to punish and prevent, never again. Well, if you're going to do that, you need to be faithful to it, right? You need to give an accurate legal and factual definition of what happened to people so that there is indeed this particular validation, but this particular stigma attached to it. There's now something called a genocidaire. Because in 1994, in about 100 days, at least 800,000 Tutsis were murdered in Rwanda. And the people who are thought to have committed it or who have been found guilty of having committed it are now called genocidaires, and it's a term that I think is going to stay and is going to be used. And it attached to it, I think, and I hope, is a particularly heavy moral stigma that these individuals will carry with them for the rest of their lives. And I think that's important. And it's only important because you apply the law. You apply the convention. You call a genocide when it is, and you don't try and misuse the law. Thank you, Professor. As a prosecutor, I'm a big believer in applying the law and not trying to stretch it beyond what it's supposed to do. I think that's what we owe society, because laws are the foundation on which we can build a society. But perhaps more importantly, I think it's what we owe the victims of these crimes. We owe their crimes, their victimization, to be recognized as such. And I think, for example, if nobody in his right mind, and apologize if, well, no, I won't apologize, actually. I don't think anybody in his right mind can now deny that there was a Tutsi genocide in Rwanda. The courts have recognized it as a fact, and I think anyone who's intellectually honest does so today, and that will remain an unfortunate legacy of what happened, and the judicial process of the ICTR. Calling something by its name, I think, is fundamentally important, and it is a recognition of what happened to the people who are victimized. And I don't think it's negating what happened to these people, and I think it is certainly not forgetting what happened to them. And I think Professor Yerushalmi quite accurately said it, that the antonym of forgetting is not remembering, but it's rather justice. And hopefully, by continuing to prosecute genocide, we'll do so. Thank you very much.
Okay, now my colleague Paya Makavan will offer a few comments, and then we'll have a few minutes left for questions and comments from the audience.
I'd like to thank our guest for his very thoughtful remarks. The last time I met, we actually met a while ago in Ottawa, but I remember meeting you just after your appointment when you were on your way to Cambodia, and mm-hmm. I can only imagine all the things that you've seen in the 3 years that you spent there. I want you to just very quickly reflect a bit on the broader historical context within which we have to understand the Cambodia Tribunal and its imperfections, which I'm sure Mr. Petit was very diplomatic about, but it is a profoundly flawed tribunal, and we have to think about why the tribunal was created so late and was created in this very unusual way, with two co-prosecutors, two co-investigating magistrates, a supermajority rule before the trial chamber and the appeals chamber. And I think that the bottom line, as I will explain in this historical process, is that it was a question of imperfect justice or no justice at all. This tribunal was the last chance to bring the Khmer Rouge to justice. And I wanted to, in a sense, pay tribute to our colleague here, who I think has been very diplomatic about how difficult it is to work in a system where there are parallel institutions, all forms of political interference, but at the same time one has to decide whether this is worth pursuing, because it's the only thing on offer for the victims, frankly speaking, before the Khmer Rouge die off, and the average age of the accused is probably late 70s, early 80s, and that's a reality that we have to take into account. Now, one thing that we have to consider is that the Khmer Rouge didn't come out of nowhere. The Khmer Rouge came into power in 1975 at the same time as the U.S. withdrawal from Vietnam, and the radicalization of Cambodia had a lot to do with the expansion of the Vietnam War. You'll know about the Ho Chi Minh Trail and the sort of carpet bombing of Cambodia. Leaving that context aside, the fact is that when the Khmer Rouge was in power, the international community condemned its atrocities. This included the Western powers. It included the Southeast Asian powers, the neighboring countries, Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore. It also included the Soviet camp, because the Khmer Rouge were clients of the People's Republics of China at that point in time. In 1979, it was effectively the Vietnamese invasion that ended the Khmer Rouge atrocities. Whatever one may think about Vietnam and its invasion, that was the reason why the killings stopped. So we go back to the legacy of Vietnam as a hegemonic regional power, and the context within which that first trial in absentia took place. But what happened in 1979 was the beginning of a profoundly shameful chapter in the history of the United Nations. Because those same Western powers and Southeast Asian nations that had condemned the atrocities of the Khmer Rouge all of a sudden became so concerned with Soviet and Vietnamese influence in Indochina, this in the context of the Cold War in 1979, that all of a sudden they realized that the only counterforce that they could use against the Vietnamese-backed government of Hun Sen, who's still prime minister today, would be the Khmer Rouge. So all of a sudden, the Khmer Rouge was rehabilitated politically and was essentially given weapons and support. There were basically refugee camps in Thailand, which became mini-states where the Khmer Rouge controlled a certain population from which they would receive international sort of relief, but also use it as a basis for launching their operations in order to destabilize the Vietnamese-backed regime in Phnom Penh. And this was a very, I would say, Faustian, to put it mildly, alliance between the People's Republic of China, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, and the Western powers. And we cannot forget that the Khmer Rouge was part of the delegation that represented Cambodia, the sort of government in exile that represented Cambodia at the United Nations, until 1993. And what is most outrageous is that in 1993, when the UN Transitional Authority in Cambodia held elections, the Khmer Rouge was one of the political parties for which people could vote. So we can imagine what the world would have looked like if in 1945 there was a UN-sponsored election in post-war Germany, and alongside the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, you could vote for the Nazi Party. That is the legacy with which we have to understand the profound failure of the United Nations and the international community. So why did the Cambodian government all of a sudden in 1997 decide to establish this tribunal? And I found myself for the first time in Phnom Penh in 1997 when the Cambodian government finally decided, based on the precedent of the Yugoslav and Rwanda tribunals, that it too wanted an international criminal tribunal for Cambodia. What was interesting is there was no talk about a mixed tribunal back then. They wanted a full-fledged tribunal. And the discussion was whether the tribunal should be in The Hague, whether maybe it could be in Singapore, somewhere in the region. Some people were talking about Australia. This is back in 1997. What happened is that in 1997, the Khmer Rouge, having lost in elections, decided to go back to the bush and to destabilize once again the Cambodian government from neighboring Thailand and certain border areas of Cambodia. So the Cambodian government decided that the best way to get rid of them was to set up a tribunal. And this is an interesting legacy now of how politicians use international criminal courts to try and eliminate their enemies, sometimes with justification, sometimes with less justification. It was in that context that I went for the first time in Phnom Penh and began to speak about what some of these different options were. Then a working group was established by the UN General Assembly to make a proposal, and they proposed some form of international criminal tribunal. But then in 1998, Pol Pot either died or was murdered. No one knows for sure. Maybe our friend can tell us what happened. But in any event, Pol Pot was eliminated. Pol Pot, the leader of the Khmer Rouge. And a series of deals were made to end the sort of insurgency, one of which was to allow people like Yang Sari, Khieu Samphan, Nuon, all the leading culprits that were mentioned, to come back to Cambodia based either on a formal pardon in the case of Yang Sari, or in the case of other characters, some sort of understanding that they would be unmolested. And there was a little enclave on the border with Thailand, which became a kind of mini-state for the Khmer Rouge, where these former hardline communists ran casinos and brothels and engaged in the illegal trade in minerals and in gemstones and lumber, very often in collaboration with members of the Cambodian government, who also had a stake in this. And that became an understanding that let bygones be bygones, let's sweep everything under the carpet and end the war. So all of a sudden, the Cambodian government had no interest anymore in having an international tribunal, because it could potentially complicate this modus vivendi. Part of the reason why we ended up with this sort of tribunal was that ultimately the government wanted to have a measure of control, which it wouldn't have had there been a full-fledged tribunal. And the second time I ended up in Cambodia was when, as our distinguished guest mentioned, the talks collapsed between the United Nations and Cambodia. And it was very interesting because the legal counsel to the United Nations then was Swedish diplomat Hans Corell, a very, very correct bureaucrat that I'd known for a number of years. And you can imagine the cultural clash of this very pedantic, correct Swedish bureaucrat sitting down with someone like Hun Sen, who, you know, was a very rough politician brought up in the radical context of, you know, the Khmer Rouge and the Vietnamese invasion, and it was not much of a surprise that those talks collapsed. And one of the attempts that I was trying to make back then with the supporters of the Open Society Institute was to find, together with people like David Sheffer and others, some sort of compromise solution. And at the end of the day, the compromise was what our guests spoke about, a very unwieldy and unusual and unprecedented structure, and one I hope that will never be repeated again in another tribunal. But in this case, I would say better imperfect justice rather than no justice at all. And it would have been a grave tragedy if there would have been no tribunal at all and these accused would have died. A couple of quick points before opening the floor for discussion. One is that beyond this tribunal, I think we have to understand that a judicial process is not about the victims, it is about the accused. This is something that we have to remember. However popular it may be to say it's all about the victims, it's not about the victims. It's incidentally about the victims. It's about the accused and what the accused has done. Meaning to say that when you have a prosecution, you can only bring in the testimony of those victims that can attribute their suffering to that particular accused. Which is why, at the end of the day, even if you prosecute the top leader who's responsible for the overall context of suffering, you cannot possibly bring in anything more than a handful of victims to testify. Trials take a very long time. Preparing witnesses, examining them, cross-examining them, is very, very difficult, cumbersome work, something which our guest explained people from the outside may not understand. And at the end of the day, there may be a need in Cambodia for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which will allow the thousands of people who obviously cannot be brought into the judicial process to tell their story, to vindicate their suffering, not within the very strict and regimented confines of judicial process, but as part of a broader healing process, because, as was mentioned, basically everyone in Cambodia in one way or another was deeply affected by the atrocities of those years. Final remark about this whole debate about the so-called genocide label. It's very interesting, too, that when I spoke to the Cambodian judges in 1997 and I explained to them that most of the crimes of the Khmer Rouge would probably not qualify as genocide in a legal sense, that they were scandalized. Why were they scandalized? They were scandalized because we have created, I would say, a very perverse discourse where instead of understanding the intimate reality of what happened on the ground, instead of looking at the facts and the narrative of the victims, we choose instead to see the world through hierarchical abstractions. And genocide somehow occupies this very privileged normative space, and everything else is second best. Your suffering is either genocide or it's not really worthy of our consideration because it falls into this black hole of everything that is not genocide. At the end of the day, I would suggest, in a provocative way, that there is no magic to genocide. It is merely a legal concept. It is a legal concept with a specific meaning, and one has to look at every specific context on its own merits. What is wrong with calling what happened in Cambodia a crime against humanity? Is a crime against humanity somehow less worthy of our attention? The point here is that when Rwanda was occurring, there was a big debate about whether to call it genocide or not. Some of you who have looked into that incident will be familiar with that. And the activists said that, yes, indeed, it is genocide. And if we called it genocide, the world would have done something. 10 years later, as Darfur was unfolding, Secretary of State Colin Powell went before the world and said, what is happening is a genocide. I'll tell you what happened. The Security Council established a commission of inquiry that spent 3 months debating whether it is or is not genocide, and the world still did nothing. It made not a shred of difference what we called that situation. The fact is that until we have a more intimate connection with the reality of the victims, all of these legal debates that we professors and practitioners would love to engage in are not really going to make much of a difference. With that, I will hand the floor back to René Corbeau.
Okay, I feel a wave of optimism coming over the room after these cheerful talks. So we'll take we have time for a few questions. We'll take a number of questions and then give a chance to the panelists to answer. So, sir, if you want.
That's the issue that I was going to bring up. Since the United States and the CIA was basically supporting the Khmer Rouge after the Vietnamese invasion, then are they not also equally responsible to some extent? Because the Khmer Rouge was also conducting genocide within the areas that they were under control. And the other issue that I want to present is that not only did they support them, they also supplied them and they armed them. And there was a similar situation after the Second World War whereby Nazi leaders and many East European anti-Semites who actually committed genocide against the Jews, like Klaus Barbie, were actually protected by the CIA and they were flown over to Bolivia. And Gehlen, who was head of the Nazi intelligence unit, was flown over to Egypt. And Stepan Bandera, who was responsible for killing 50,000 Jews in Belarus and the Ukraine, was actually a member of the, supported by the MI6, MI5, and by the CIA in West Germany before he was assassinated by some Soviet counterintelligence spies. This is in 1940-52. So the idea is, are they not also responsible since they themselves are also supported these type of people, and have they not also some responsibility for perpetuating or at least supporting them? Which also brings up the issue of what type of genocide. In Guatemala, a lot of people talk about the genocide in Cambodia or Rwanda. That's because it was committed by groups that were not supported, or government or groups that were not pro-U.S. What about the groups that were pro-U.S. in Latin America, like Guatemala, whereby you had 300,000 Mayan Indians basically in a war of extermination over the question of oil, and or Fujimori was actually conducting abortions on Quechua Indians. Those, the international community, certainly those who from the United States or the West, have not ever raised. So isn't there a kind of hypocrisy, a sort of double standards, that if it's my gangsters that are doing, if we kind of protect them, if it's the other person's gangsters, be the French who supported the Hutus by supplying them arms to commit the genocide, or the Cambodians which were involved with the Chinese, then you go after them. But you don't go after U.S.-sponsored governments who commit genocide.
Thank you. As I said, we'll take a number of questions. So, madam.
Well, I don't know if this is a question or a comment, but it's a comment and you can comment on it. I don't see so much difficulty with what is basically a Marxist-inspired or ideological or class or economic or social class-based genocide, because it intersects with national or religious or ethnic genocide using the concept of culture, because an economic and social class is also involved in a concept of culture. And what the Khmer were doing were delegitimating entire groups of people within their country that defined Khmer culture a certain way, and they were using a certain ideology to wrest away what that definition of culture was. So culture can be used to link the two. You see the same kinds of killing in the Bolshevik Revolution and also in the Chinese, in the Cultural Revolution, where social and economic ideology is used to delegitimate entire classes and groups of people. And it can be a certain set of things can be used to characterize it, like is the sudden criminalization of behavior, the sudden deprivation of what previously existing rights, the sudden onslaught of terror, the sudden denial of due process, any kind of due process that existed in those societies before. Obviously, in some cases, they didn't. The use of terror, a penchant for torture, and also a penchant for documenting what they're doing. So, and it's all used to basically legitimate what could be understood to be highly criminal, sociopathic, and violent behavior. So I don't see it as really being difficult, even though the genocide is not national.
Thank you, and we'll take a last question and then give a chance to answer.
In varying degrees, complexities of law and politics are involved in all of these cases of genocide, and I would suggest they're not simply the result of the complexities of time and space and money and the desire to have justice, but I would suggest they're part of the very design and fabric to make sure that countries or the world, or the United Nations, will not easily interfere in future genocides. In other words, you deliberately design a system that has built-in obstacles that makes it difficult to interfere and stop genocide. So I think part of the process is, or part of the reasons we're in a mess we are today is because of the faulty system which was intended to correct things, but instead has become part of the cause.
Thank you.
Well, I guess most of these, these interventions really intersect with one another. And yeah, there is a difference between a court of law and the political realities, and nobody, and is the system, is the current system of nations unfair, and do people still get away with it, and shouldn't countries be held accountable? Yes, 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 yes. But fact of the matter is, courts of law, if they're going to have to any meaning, if they're going to be of any usefulness, they are there to try individuals for their individual crimes. They are not there to try ideas. They are not there to try religions, beliefs, even motives. They are there to try individuals for their actions, so that at the end of it, at the end of the process, that person, and Payam is right, it is about a person, that person will be found guilty or acquitted. Judgments to be passed on nations, to be passed on organizations, to be passed on ideas, on anything else, belongs outside of court of laws. And if you don't have that separation, I'm afraid you have nothing. And there's currently a spat of prosecution in Cambodia for libel and for spreading misinformation. And funnily enough, these prosecutions all target members of the opposition of the current government. When you start using the courts for something that it's not made for, you have lost the game. And in terms of, well, I'm happy you don't find any problems with defining the groups. Maybe... we should have a further chat. But in terms of the legal process, that unfortunately that question has proven to be very difficult. And the judicial process is different from other sciences, it's different from other professions, it's different from anything else, right? It has to have a very strict application to have as to function. And unfortunately, defining these four groups has been difficult. And it has been difficult because you're right, in essence, sir. Some of these people who should have been protected are not there, and they're purposely not there. And if you're referring to the system writ large, if you mean the use of statutes to protect individuals or groups, well, of course, they're all inherently determined by political considerations. Hopefully, by having this push that we've had for the last 15 years or so to end impunity, to create these bodies that will hold people accountable, even if they win, right? Because no criminal, of course, goes into it believing that he or she is going to get caught. They all think they're going to get away with it. Well, the message that the international community is sending now, with the creation of the International Criminal Court, with all these institutions, with this very active civil society, people from people in university, young people to older people, documenting these things, raising a fuss, letting it be known that people are watching and people will be held accountable. Hopefully, that process will make us a little bit better and will eventually achieve what you're hoping.
Is there hypocrisy? Absolutely. That's my answer. That's part of the problem, that we have a very cynical political culture within which these judicial institutions have to function. And the fact that we have any of these judicial institutions is something we can't take for granted. Until the Yugoslav Tribunal was established in 1993, there wasn't a single attempt by the United Nations to bring anyone to justice, despite the fact that we had a mass murder of tens of millions of people, Idi Amin's Uganda, Mengistu's Ethiopia, the list goes on and on of the cynicism. So the whole judicial enterprise, despite all its imperfections, is an attempt to shift that culture away from impunity to accountability. And that's why I was saying that the fact that we had any justice, we had late and limited justice, was far better than having had no justice at all. The question of providing weapons and support to groups that may be convenient, but that may do some very unfortunate things, is a very relevant one. I worked, among other things, with the UN Historical Clarification Commission in Guatemala, and among other things, I looked at the essentially the extermination of the Mayan Indians in an area called the Ischial Triangle, and about 150,000 Mayan civilians were murdered by right-wing death squads with CIA training and support. So one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves beyond the moral discourse is, what is the responsibility in criminal law of those that aid and abet and facilitate such crimes? And frankly speaking, there is a basis in criminal law for liability if you knowingly provide substantial support to someone that is committing such crimes. So the consequence very often of that cynicism has to be seen, if I may just briefly explain in the context of the Middle East, of how what goes around comes around. Saddam Hussein, throughout the Iran-Iraq war, was given support by the United States and by the Europeans. We forget that Donald Rumsfeld went in December of 1983 with a letter from Ronald Reagan, President Reagan, giving unconditional support to Saddam Hussein at a time when Iraq was using chemical weapons. But because it was being used against Iran, it was all right, because Iran was their enemy. And then in 1988-89, when for the first time since the use of Zyklon B gas in the Nazi concentration camps, Saddam Hussein used chemical weapons in the mass murder of Kurdish civilians, and Congress wanted to impose modest sanctions on Iraq, the White House vetoed. So that is part of the legacy of what happens when we appease genocidaires and mass murderers in the name of political convenience. I could also explain to you what the position of the Taliban was before September 11th. We can discuss where Osama bin Laden came from, who trained him. The list goes on and on of this really tragic, pathetic legacy of hypocrisy. So we have to understand that justice isn't just about naive idealism, but it's the only lasting basis for peace and security. And it's in that context that each of these precedents hopefully will move us in a more civilized direction.
Well, I think all of this is a very good illustration of the idea that law is neither better nor worse than the rest of social institutions that we've created. It could be used to oppress as well as to bring about justice. And international human rights lawyers and international criminal lawyers might sometimes be accused of arrogance in being taken to advance claims which cannot be sustained upon closer studies. And I think that Robert Petit's presentation is a sober, a realistic look at what can be achieved and also the limitations of international criminal law and legal processes generally to bring about the kind of fundamental social reconstruction that is required in any society affected by crimes of the magnitude such as those that occurred in Cambodia. So there will be, we have come to our time to end. There is a vain d'honneur, as is called in at McGill, in the atrium just outside. So there will be perhaps an opportunity to have a further discussion with Mr. Petit for a few more minutes. In the meantime, please join me in thanking me, both my colleague Payam and Robert Petit.
Say hello to you.